I know why. You went to work, and we went back to Never Neverland to play with the lost boys and girls. The ones who will eventually turn up in suits from Brooks Brothers and with MBAs in their pockets. I pointed to the briefcase. That would go with a suit from Brooks Brothers, if they really make suits for women, that is. She sighed. It was a gift from my parents. My father wants me to be a lawyer like him. So far, I haven't gotten up the nerve to tell him I want to be a freelance photographer. He'll blow his stack. We walked up Joyland Avenue in silence, except for the bone-like rattle of the fallen leaves. She looked at the covered rides, the dry fountain, the frozen horses on the merry-go-round, the empty story stage in the deserted Wiggle Waggle Village. Kind of sad seeing it this way. It makes me think mortal thoughts. She looked at me appraisingly. We saw the paper Mrs. Shoplaw made sure to leave it in our room. You did it again. Eddie? I just happened to be there. We had reached Madame Fortuna's shy. The lawn chairs were still leaning against it. I unfolded too and gestured for Aaron to sit down. I sat beside her, then pulled out a pint bottle of Old Log Cabin from the pocket of my jacket. Cheap whiskey, but it takes a chill off. Looking amused, she took a small nip. I took one of my own, screwed on the cap, and stowed the bottle in my pocket. 50 yards down Joyland Avenue, our midway, I could see the tall, false front of Horror House, and read the drippy green letters, "Come in if you dare." Her small hand gripped my shoulder with surprising strength. "You saved the old bastard. You did. Give yourself some credit, you." I smiled, thinking of Lane saying that I had a merit badge of modesty. Maybe giving myself credit for stuff wasn't one of my strong points in those days. "Will he live?" "Probably. Freddie Dean talked to some of the doctors who said, blah, 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 patient must give up smoking, blah, 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 patient must give up eating french fries, blah, 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 patient must begin a regular exercise regimen." "I can just see Eddie Parks jogging," Aaron said. "Uh-huh, with a cigarette in his mouth and a bag of pork rinds in his hand." She giggled. The wind gusted and blew her hair around her face. In her heavy sweater and businesslike dark gray pants, she didn't look much like the flushed American beauty who'd run around Joyland in a little green dress, smiling her pretty Aaron smile and coaxing people to let her take their picture with her old-fashioned camera. "What have you got for me? What did you find out?" She opened her briefcase and took out a folder. "Are you absolutely sure you want to get into this? Because I don't think you're going to listen, say, 'Elementary, my dear Aaron,' and spit out the killer's name like Sherlock Holmes. If I needed evidence that Sherlock Holmes I wasn't, my wild idea that Eddie Parks might have been the so-called funhouse killer was it. I thought of telling her that I was more interested in putting the victim to rest than I was in catching the killer, but it would have sounded crazy, even factoring in Tom's experience. I'm not expecting that either. And by the way, you owe me almost $40 for interlibrary loan fees." "I'm good for it." She poked me in the ribs. "You better be. I'm not working my way through school for the fun of it." She settled her briefcase between her ankles and opened the folder. I saw Xeroxes, 2 or 3 pages of typewritten notes, and some glossy photographs that looked like the kind the Coneys got when they bought the Hollywood Girls pitch. "Okay, here we go. I started with the Charleston Post Courier article you told me about." She handed me one of the Xeroxes. "It's a Sunday piece, 5,000 words of speculation and maybe 800 words of actual info. Read it later if you want. I'll summarize the salient points. 4 girls, 5 if you count her." She pointed down the midway at Horror House. "The first was Delight Mowbray, Dee Dee to her friends, from Waycross, Georgia. White, 21 years old. 2 or 3 days before she was killed, she told her good friend Jasmine Withers that she had a new boyfriend, older and very handsome. She was found beside a trail on the edge of the Okefenokee Swamp on August 31st, 1961, 9 days after she disappeared. If the guy had taken her into the swamp, even a little way, she might not have been found for a much longer time." "If ever," I said. "A body left in there would have been gator bait in 20 minutes. "Gross, but true." She handed me another Xerox. "This is a story from the Waycross Journal Herald." There was a photo. It showed a somber cop holding up a plaster cast of tire tracks. "The theory is he dumped her where he cut her throat. The tire tracks were made by a truck," the story says. "Dumped her like garbage," I said. "Also gross, but true." She handed me another Xerox newspaper clipping. "Here's number 2. Claudine Sharp from Rocky Mount, right here in North Carolina. White, 23 years old, found dead in a local theater, August 2nd, 1963. The movie being shown was Lawrence of Arabia, which happens to be very long and very loud. The guy who wrote the story quotes an unnamed police source as saying the guy probably cut her throat during one of the battle scenes. Pure speculation, of course. He left a bloody shirt and gloves, then must have walked out in the shirt he was wearing underneath. "That just about has to be the guy who killed Linda Gray," I said. "Don't you think so?" "It sure sounds like it." The cops questioned all her friends, but Claudine hadn't said anything about a new boyfriend. "Or who she was going to the movies with that night? Not even to her parents?" Aaron gave me a patient look. "She was 23, Dev, not 14. She lived all the way across town from her parents, worked in a drugstore and had a little apartment above it." "You got all that from the newspaper story?" "Of course not. I also made some calls. Practically dialed my fingers off if you want to know the truth. You owe me for the long distance, too. More about Claudine Sharp later. For now, let's move on." Victim number 3, according to the Post-Courier story, was a girl from Santee, South Carolina. Now we're up to 1965. Eva Longbottom, age 19, black, disappeared on July 4th. Her body was found 9 days later by a couple of fishermen lying on the north bank of the Santee River, raped and stabbed in the heart. The others were neither black nor raped. You can put her in the Funhouse Killer column if you want to, but I'm doubtful myself. Last victim before Linda Gray was her. She handed me what had to be a high school yearbook photo of a beautiful golden-haired girl, the kind who's the head cheerleader, the homecoming queen, dates the football quarterback, and is still liked by everyone. Darlene Stamnacker. Probably would have changed her last name if she had gotten into the movie biz, which was her stated goal. White, 19, from Maxon, North Carolina. Disappeared on June 29, 1967. Found 2 days later after a massive search inside a roadside lean-to in the Sugar Pine Willywag south of Elrod. Throat cut. Christ, she's beautiful. Didn't she have a steady boyfriend? A girl this good-looking, why do you even ask? And that's where the police went first, only he wasn't around. He and 3 of his buddies had gone camping in the Blue Ridge, and they could all vouch for him. Unless he flapped his arms and flew back, it wasn't him. "Then came Linda Gray," I said. "Number 5, if they were all murdered by the same guy, that is." Aaron raised a teacherly finger. "And only 5 if all the guy's victims have been found. There could have been others in 62, 64, 66, you get it." The wind gusted and moaned through the struts of the spin. "Now for the things that trouble me," Aaron said, as if 5 dead girls weren't troubling enough. From her folder, she took another Xerox. It was a flyer, a shout in the talk, advertising something called Manly Wellman Show of 1,000 Wonders. It showed a couple of clowns holding up a parchment listing some of the wonders, one of which was America's finest collection of freaks and oddities. There were also rides, games, fun for the kiddies, and the world's scariest funhouse. "Come in if you dare," I thought. "You got this from the interlibrary loan?" I asked. "Yes. I've decided you can get anything by way of interlibrary loan if you're willing to dig. Or maybe I should say cock and ear, because it's really the world's biggest jungle telegraph." This ad appeared in the Waycross Journal Herald. It ran during the first week of August 1961. The Wellman Carney was in Waycross when the first girl disappeared? Her name was Dee Dee Mowbray, and no, it had moved on by then. But it was there when Dee Dee told her girlfriend that she had a new boyfriend. Now look at this. It's from the Rocky Mount Telegram. Ran for a week in mid-July of 1963. Standard advance advertising. I probably don't even need to tell you that. It was another full-pager shouting Manly Wellman's Show of 1,000 Wonders. Same 2 clowns holding up the same parchment. But 2 years after the stop in Waycross, they were also promising a $10,000 cover-all Beano game, and the word freaks was nowhere to be seen. "Was the show in town when the Sharp girl was killed in the movie theater?" "Left the day before." She tapped the bottom of the sheet. "All you have to do is look at the dates, Dev." I wasn't as familiar with the timeline as she was, but I didn't bother defending myself. "The third girl? Longbottom?" I didn't find anything about a carny in the Santee area, and I sure wouldn't have found anything about the Wellman Show, because it went bust in the fall of 1964. I found that in outdoor trade and industry. So far as I, or any of my many librarian helpers could discover, it's the only trade magazine that covers the carny and amusement park biz. "Jesus, Aaron, you should forget photography and find yourself a rich writer or movie producer. Hire on as his research assistant." "I'd rather take pictures. Research is too much like work, but don't lose the thread here, Devin. There was no carny in the Santee area, true, but the Eva Longbottom murder doesn't look like the other four anyway. Not to me. No rape in the others, remember? That you know of. Newspapers are coy about that stuff. That's right, they say molested or sexually assaulted instead of raped, but they get the point across, believe me. What about Darlene Shoemaker? Was there... Stamnacker. These girls were murdered, Dev. The least you can do is get their names right. I will. Give me time. She put a hand over mine. Sorry, I'm throwing this at you all at once, aren't I? I've had weeks to brood over it. Have you been? Sort of. It's pretty awful. She was right. If you read a whodunit or see a mystery movie, you can whistle gaily past whole heaps of corpses, only interested in finding out if it was the butler or the evil stepmother. But these have been real young women. Crows had probably ripped their flesh. Maggots would have infested their eyes and squirmed up their noses and into the gray meat of their brains. Was there a carny in the Max scenario when the Stamnacker girl was killed? No, but there was a county fair about to start in Lumberton. That's the nearest town of any size. Here. She handed me another Xerox. This one advertising the Robeson County Summer Fair. Once again, Erin tapped the sheet. This time she was calling my attention to a line reading, 50 safe rides provided by Southern Star Amusements. I also looked Southern Star up in outdoor trade and industry. The company's been around since after World War II. They're based in Birmingham and travel all over the South, putting up rides. Nothing so grand as the Thunderball or the Delirium Shaker, but they've got plenty of chump shoots and the jocks to run them. I had to grin at that. She hadn't forgotten all the talk, it seemed. Chump shoots were rides that could be easily put up or taken down. If you've ever ridden the Crazy Cups or the Wild Mouse, you've been on a chump shoot. I called the ride boss at Southern Star, said I'd worked at Joyland this summer and was doing a term paper on the amusement industry for my sociology class. Which I just might do, you know. After all this, it'd be a slam dunk. He told me what I had already guessed, that there was a big turnover in their line of work. He couldn't tell me offhand if they had picked anyone up from the Wellman show, but he said it was likely. A couple of roughies here, a couple of jocks there, maybe a ride monkey or two. So the guy who killed Dee Dee and Claudine could have been at that fair, and Darlene Stamnacker could have met him. The fair wasn't officially open for business yet, but lots of townies gravitate to the local fairgrounds to watch the ride monkeys and the local gazoonies do the setup. She looked at me levelly. And I think that's just what happened. Erin, is the carny link in the story the Post Courier published after Linda Gray was killed? Or maybe I should call it the amusement link. Nope. Can I have another nip from your bottle? I'm cold. We can go inside. No, it's this murder stuff that makes me cold. Every time I go over it. I gave her the bottle, and after she'd taken her nip, I took one of my own. Maybe you're Sherlock Holmes, I said. What about the cops? You think they missed it? I don't know for sure, but I think they did. If this was a detective show on TV, there'd be one smart old cop, a Lieutenant Columbo type, who'd look at the big picture and put it together. But I guess there aren't many guys like that in real life. Besides, the big picture's hard to see because it's scattered across 3 states in 8 years. One thing you can be sure of is that if he ever worked at Joyland, he's long gone. I'm sure the turnover in an amusement park isn't as fast as it is in a road company like Southern Star Amusements, but there are still plenty of people leaving and coming in. I knew that for myself. Ride jocks and concession shouters aren't exactly the most grounded people, and gazoonies went in and out like the tide. Now here's the other thing that troubles me, she said, and handed me one little pile of 8x10 photos. Printed on the white border at the bottom of each was photo taken by your Joyland Hollywood girl. I shuffled through them and felt in need of another nip when I realized what they were. The photo showing Linda Gray and the man who had killed her. Jesus God, Erin. These aren't newspaper pics. Where did you get them? Brenda Rafferty. I had to butter her up a little, tell her what a good mom she's been to all of us Hollywood girls. But in the end, she came through. These are fresh prints made from negatives she had in her personal files and loaned to me. Here's something interesting, Dev. You see the headband that Gray girl's wearing? Yes. An Alice band, Mrs. Shoplaw had called it. A blue Alice band. Brenda said they fuzzed that out in the shots they gave to the newspapers. They thought it would help them nail the guy, but it never did. So what troubles you? God knew all the pictures troubled me. Even the ones where Gray and the man she was with were just passing in the background, only recognizable by her sleeveless blouse and Alice band, and his baseball cap and dark glasses. In only two of them were Linda Gray and her killer sharp and clear. The first showed them at the Whirly Cups, his hand resting casually on the swell of Gray's bottom. In the other, the best of the lot, they were at the Annie Oakley shooting gallery. Yet in neither was the man's face really visible. I could have passed him on the street and not known. Aaron plucked up the Whirly Cups photo. Look at his hand. Yeah, the tattoo, I see it, and I heard about it from Mrs. S. What do you make it to be, a hawk or an eagle? I think an eagle, but it doesn't matter. Really? Really. Remember I said I'd come back to Claudine Sharp? A young woman getting her throat cut in a local movie theater during Lawrence of Arabia, no less, was big news in a little town like Rocky Mount. The telegram ran with it for almost a month. The cops turned up exactly one lead, Dev. A girl Claudine went to high school with saw her at the snack bar and said hello. Claudine said hi right back. The girl said there was a man in sunglasses and a baseball cap next to her, but she never thought the guy was with Claudine because he was a lot older. The only reason she noticed him at all was because he was wearing sunglasses in a movie show, and because he had a tattoo on his hand. The bird. No, Dev, it was a Coptic cross. Like this. She took out another Xerox sheet and showed me. She told the cops she thought at first it was some kind of Nazi symbol. I looked at the cross. It was elegant, but looked nothing at all like a bird. Two tats, one on each hand, I said at last. The bird on one, the cross on the other. She shook her head and gave me the Whirly Cups photo again. Which hand's got the bird on it? He was standing on Linda Gray's left, encircling her waist, the hand resting on her bottom. The right? Yes, but the girl who saw him in the movie theater said the cross was on his right. I considered this. She made a mistake, that's all. Witnesses do it all the time. Sure they do. My father could talk all day on that subject. But look, Dev. Aaron handed me the shooting gallery photo, the best of the bunch because they weren't just passing in the background. A roving Hollywood girl had seen them, noted the cute pose and snapped them, hoping for a sale. Only the guy had given her the brush off, a hard brush off, according to Mrs. Shoplaw. That made me remember how she described the photo. Him snuggled up to her hip to hip, showing her how to hold the rifle the way guys always do. The version Mrs. S. saw would have been a fuzzy newspaper reproduction, made up of little dots. This was the original. So sharp and clear, I almost felt I could step into it and warn the gray girl. He was snuggled up to her, his hand over hers on the barrel of the BB shooting 22, helping her aim. It was his left hand, and there was no tattoo on it. Aaron said, "You see it, don't you? There's nothing to see." That's the point, Dev. That's exactly the point. Are you saying that it was two different guys? That one with a cross on his hand killed Claudine Sharp, and another one, a guy with a bird on his hand, killed Linda Gray? That doesn't seem very likely. I couldn't agree more. Then what are you saying? I thought I saw something in one of the photos, but I wasn't sure. So I took the print and the negative to a grad student named Phil Hendren. He's a darkroom genius, practically lives in the Bard photography department. You know those clunky speed graphics we carried? Sure. They were mostly for effect. Cute girls toting old-fashioned cameras. But Phil says they're actually pretty terrific. You can do a lot with these negs. For example, she handed me a blow-up of the Whirly Cups pic. The Hollywood girl's target had been a young couple with a toddler between them. But in this enlarged version, they were hardly there. Now, Linda Gray and her murderous date were at the center of the image. Look at his hand, Dev. Look at the tattoo. I did, frowning. It's a little hard to see, I complained. The hand's blurrier than the rest. I don't think so. This time I held the photo close to my eyes. It's... Jesus, Aaron. Is it the ink? Is it running just a little? She gave me a triumphant smile. July of 1969, a hot night in Dixie, almost everybody was sweating buckets. If you don't believe me, look at some of the other pictures and note the perspiration rings. Plus, he had something else to be sweaty about, didn't he? He had murder on his mind, an audacious one at that. I said, "Oh, shit. Pirate Pete's." She pointed a forefinger at me. Bingo. Pirate Pete's was a souvenir shop outside the Splash and Crash, proudly flying a Jolly Roger from its roof. Inside, you could get the usual stuff, t-shirts, coffee mugs, beach towels, even a pair of swim trunks if your kid forgot his. Everything imprinted with the Joyland logo. There was also a counter where you could get a wide assortment of fake tattoos. They came on decals. If you didn't feel capable of applying it yourself, Pirate Pete, or one of his greeny minions, would do it for a small surcharge. Aaron was nodding. I doubt he got it there. That would have been dumb, and this guy isn't dumb. But I'm sure it's not a real tattoo, any more than that Coptic cross the girl saw in the Rocky Mount movie theater was a real tattoo. She leaned forward and gripped my arm. You know what I think? I think he does it because it draws attention. People notice the tattoo, and everything else just... She tapped the indistinct shapes that had been the actual subject of this photo before her friend at Bard blew it up. I said, everything else about him just fades into the background. Yep. Later he just washes it off. Do the cops know? I have no idea. You could tell them. Not me. I'm going back to school, but I'm not sure they'd care at this late date. I shuffled through the photos again. I had no doubt that Aaron had actually discovered something, although I did doubt it would, by itself, be responsible for the capture of the funhouse killer. But there was something else about the photos. Something. You know how sometimes a word gets stuck on the tip of your tongue and just won't come off? It was like that. Have there been any murders like these five, or these four if we leave out Eva Longbottom, since Linda Gray? Did you check? I tried, she said. The short answer is I don't think so, but I can't say for sure. I've read about 50 murders of young girls and women, 50 at least, and haven't found any that fit the parameters. She ticked them off. Always in summer. Always as a result of a dating situation with an unknown older man. Always the throat cut. And always with some sort of carny connect. Hello, kids. We looked up, startled. It was Fred Dean. Today he was wearing a golfing shirt, bright red baggies, and a long-billed cap with Heaven's Bay Country Club stitched in gold thread above the rim. I was a lot more used to seeing him in a suit, where informality consisted of pulling down his tie and popping the top button of his Van Heusen shirt. Dressed for the links, he looked absurdly young. Except for the graying wings of hair at his temples, that was. Hello, Mr. Dean, Aaron said, standing up. Most of her paperwork and some of the photographs were still clutched in one hand. The folder was in the other. I don't know if you remember me. Of course I do, he said, approaching. I never forget a Hollywood girl, but sometimes I do mix up the names. Are you Ashley or Jerry? She smiled, put the paperwork back in the folder, and handed it to me. I added the photos I was still holding. I'm Aaron. Of course. Aaron Cook. He dropped me a wink, which is even weirder than seeing him in old-fashioned golfing baggies. You have excellent taste in young ladies, Jonesy. I do, don't I? It seemed too complicated to tell him that Aaron was actually Tom Kennedy's girlfriend. Fred probably wouldn't remember Tom anyway, never having seen him in a flirty green dress and high heels. I just stopped by to get the accounts books. Quarterly IRS payments coming up. Such a pain in the hindquarters. Enjoying your little alumna visit, Aaron? Yes, sir, very much. Coming back next year? She looked a trifle uncomfortable at that, but stuck gamely to the truth. Probably not. Fair enough, but if you change your mind, I'm sure Brenda Rafferty can find a place for you. He switched his attention to me. This boy you plan to bring to the park, Jonesy. He set a date with his mother? Tuesday. Wednesday or Thursday if it's rainy. The kid can't be out in the rain. Aaron was looking at me curiously. I advise you stick to Tuesday, he said. There's a storm coming up the coast. Not a hurricane, thank God, but a tropical disturbance. Lots of rain and gale-force winds is what they're saying. Supposed to arrive mid-morning on Wednesday. Okay, I said. Thanks for the tip. Nice to see you again, Aaron. He tipped his cap to her and started off toward the back lot. Aaron waited until he was out of sight before bursting into giggles. Those pants, did you see those pants? Yeah, I said. Pretty wild. But I was damned if I was going to laugh at them. Or him. According to Lane, Fred Dean held Joyland together with spit, bailing wire, and an account book wizardry. That being the case, I thought he could wear all the golf baggies he wanted. and at least they weren't checks. What's this about bringing some kid to the park? Long story, I said. I'll tell you while we walk back. So I did, giving her the Boy Scout majoring in modesty version and leaving out the big argument at the hospital. Erin listened without interruption, asking only one question just as we reached the steps leading up from the beach. Tell me the truth, Dev. Is Mommy Foxy? People kept asking me that. That night, Tom and Erin went out to Surfer Joe's, a beer and boogie bar where they had spent more than a few off nights during the summer. Tom invited me along, but I heeded that old saying about two being company and three being you-know-what. Besides, I doubted if they'd find the same raucous, party-hardy atmosphere. In towns like Heaven's Bay, there's a big difference between July and October. In my role as Big Brother, I even said so. You don't understand, Dev, Tom said. Me and Erin don't go looking for the fun. We bring the fun. It's what we learned last summer. Nevertheless, I heard them coming up the stairs early, and almost sober from the sound of them. Yet there were whispers and muffled laughter, sounds that made me feel a little lonely. Not for Wendy, just for someone. Looking back on it, I suppose even that was a step forward. I read through Erin's notes while they were gone, but found nothing new. I set them aside after 15 minutes and went back to the photographs. Crisp, black and white images, taken by your Joyland Hollywood girl. At first, I just shuffled through them. Then I sat on the floor and laid them out in a square, moving them from place to place like a guy trying to put a puzzle together, which was, I suppose, exactly what I was doing. Erin was troubled by the Carney connection and the tattoos that probably weren't real tattoos at all. Those things troubled me as well, but there was something else, something I couldn't quite get. It was maddening because I felt like it was staring me right in the face. Finally, I put all but two of the photos back in the folder, the key two. These I held up, looking first at one, then the other. Linda Gray and her killer waiting in line at the Whirly Cups. Linda Gray and her killer at the shooting gallery. Never mind the goddamn tattoo, I told myself. It's not that. It's something else. But what else could it be? The sunglasses masked his eyes. The goatee masked his lower face, and the slightly tilted bill of the baseball cap shaded his forehead and eyebrows. The Caps logo showed a catfish peering out of a big red sea, the insignia of a South Carolina minor league team called the Mudcats. Dozens of Mudcat lids went through the park every day at the height of the season, so many that we called them fish tops instead of dog tops. The bastard could hardly have picked a more anonymous lid, and surely that was the idea. Back and forth I went, from the Whirly Cups to the shooting gallery and then back to the Whirly Cups again. At last, I tossed the photos in the folder and threw the folder on my little desk. I read until Tom and Erin came in, then went to bed. Maybe it'll come to me in the morning, I thought. I'll wake up and say, oh shit, of course. The sound of the incoming waves slipped me into sleep. I dreamed I was on the beach with Annie and Mike. Annie and I were standing with our feet in the surf, our arms around each other, watching Mike fly his kite. He was paying out twine and running after it. He could do that because there was nothing wrong with him. He was fine. I had only dreamed that stuff about Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. I woke up early because I had forgotten to pull down the shade. I went to the folder, pulled out those two photographs, and stared at them in the day's first sunlight, positive I'd see the answer. But I didn't. A harmony of scheduling had allowed Tom and Erin to travel from New Jersey to North Carolina together, but when it comes to train schedules, harmony is the exception rather than the rule. The only ride they got together on Sunday was the one from Heaven's Bay to Wilmington in my Ford. Erin's train left for upstate New York and Annandale and Hudson 2 hours before Tom's Coastal Express was due to whisk him back to New Jersey. I tucked a check in her jacket pocket, interlibrary loans and long distance. She fished it out, looked at the amount, and tried to hand it back. $80 is too much, Dev. Considering all you found out, it's not enough. Take it, Lieutenant Columbo. She laughed, put it back in her pocket, and kissed me goodbye. Another brother-sister quickie. Nothing like the one we'd shared that night at the end of the summer. She spent considerably longer in Tom's arms. Promises were made about Thanksgiving at Tom's parents' home in western Pennsylvania. I could tell he didn't want to let her go. But when the loudspeakers announced last call for Richmond, Baltimore, Wilkes-Barre, and points north, he finally did. When she was gone, Tom and I strolled across the street and had an early dinner in a not-too-bad ribs joint. I was contemplating the dessert selection when he cleared his throat and said, "Listen, Dev." Something in his voice made me look up in a hurry. His cheeks were even more flushed than usual. I put the menu down. "This stuff you've had Erin doing, I think it should stop. It's bothering her, and I think she's neglecting her coursework." He laughed, glanced out the window at the train station bustle, looked back at me. "I sound more like her dad than her boyfriend, don't I?"
"You sound concerned, that's all. Like you care for her."
"Care for her? Buddy, I'm head over heels in love. She's the most important thing in my life." "What I'm saying here isn't jealousy talking, though."
"I don't want you to get that idea. Here's the thing. If she's going to transfer and still hold on to her financial aid, she can't let her grades slip. You see that, don't you?"
Yes, I could see that. I could see something else, too, even if Tom couldn't. He wanted her away from Joyland in mind as well as body, because something had happened to him there that he couldn't understand. Nor did he want to, which, in my opinion, made him sort of a fool. That dour flush of envy ran through me again, causing my stomach to clench around the food it was trying to digest. Then I smiled. It was an effort, I won't kid you about that, and said,
"Message received. As far as I'm concerned, our little research project is over."
"So relax, Thomas. You can stop thinking about what happened in Horror House and about what you saw there."
"Good. We're still friends, right?"
I reached across the table. "Friends to the end," I said. We shook on it. The Wiggle Waggle Village's story stage had three backdrops. Prince Charming's castle, Jack's magic beanstalk, and a starry night sky featuring the Carolina Spind outlined in red neon. All three had sun-faded over the course of the summer. I was in the Wiggle Waggle's small backstage area on Monday morning, touching them up, and hoping not to fuck them up, I was no Van Gogh, when one of the part-time gazoonies arrived with a message from Fred Dean. I was wanted in his office. I went with some unease, wondering if I was going to get a reaming for bringing Erin into the park on Saturday. I was surprised to find Fred dressed not in one of his suits or his amusing golf outfit, but in faded jeans and an equally faded Joyland t-shirt, the short sleeves rolled up to show some real muscle. There was a paisley sweatband cinched around his brow. He didn't look like an accountant or the park's chief employment officer. He looked like a ride jock. He registered my surprise and smiled.
"Like the outfit? I must admit I do. It's the way I dressed when I caught on with the Blitz Brothers show in the Midwest back in the 50s. My mother was okay with the Blitzies, but my dad was horrified. And he was carny."
"I know," I said. He raised his eyebrows.
"Really? Word gets around, doesn't it? Anyway, there's a lot to do this afternoon."
"Just give me a list. I'm almost done painting the backdrops and the..."
"Not at all, Jonesy. You're signing out at noon today, and I don't want to see you until tomorrow morning at 9 when you turn up with your guests. Don't worry about your paycheck either. I'll see you're not docked for the hours you miss."
"What's this about, Fred?" He gave me a smile I couldn't interpret.
"It's a surprise."
That Monday was warm and sunny, and Annie and Mike were having lunch at the end of the boardwalk when I walked back to Heaven's Bay. Milo saw me coming and raced to meet me.
"Dev!" Mike called. "Come and have a sandwich. We got plenty."
"No, I really shouldn't."
"We insist," Annie said. Then her brow furrowed.
"Unless you're sick or something, I don't want Mike to catch a bug."
"I'm fine. Just got sent home early. Mr. Dean, he's my boss. He wouldn't tell me why. He said it was a surprise.
It's got something to do with tomorrow, I guess." I looked at her with some anxiety.
"We're still on for tomorrow, right?"
"Yes," she said. "When I surrender, I surrender. Just, we're not going to tire him out, are we, Dev?"
"Mom," Mike said.
She paid him no mind.
"Are we?"
"No, ma'am." Although seeing Fred Dean dressed up like a carny road dog with all those unsuspected muscles showing had made me uneasy. Had I made it clear to him how fragile Mike's health was? I thought so, but...
"Then come up here and have a sandwich," she said. I hope you like egg salad. I didn't sleep well on Monday night, half convinced that the tropical storm Fred had mentioned would arrive early and wash out Mike's trip to the park, but Tuesday dawned cloudless. I crept down to the parlor, turned on the TV in time to get the 6:45 weathercast on WECT. The storm was still coming, but the only people who were going to feel it today were the ones living in coastal Florida and Georgia. I hoped Mr. Easterbrook had packed his galoshes.
"You're up early," Mrs. Shoplaw said, poking her head in from the kitchen. "I was just making scrambled eggs and bacon. Come have some."
"I'm not that hungry, Mrs. S."
"Nonsense, you're still a growing boy, Devin, and you need to eat. Aaron told me what you got going on today, and I think you're doing a wonderful thing. It will be fine."
"I hope you're right," I said. But I kept thinking of Fred Dean in his work clothes. Fred, who'd sent me home early. Fred, who had a surprise planned. We had made our arrangements at lunch the day before, and when I turned my old car into the driveway of the big green Victorian at 8:30 on Tuesday morning, Annie and Mike were ready to go. So was Milo.
"Are you sure nobody will mind us bringing him?" Mike had asked on Monday.
"I don't want to get into trouble."
"Service dogs are allowed in Joyland," I said. "And Milo's going to be a service dog. Aren't you, Milo?" Milo had cocked his head, apparently unfamiliar with the service dog concept. Today, Mike was wearing his huge, clanky braces. I moved to help him into the van, but he waved me off and did it himself. It took a lot of effort, and I expected a coughing fit, but none came. He was practically bouncing with excitement. Annie, looking impossibly long-legged in Lee Riders, handed me the van keys. "You drive." And lowering her voice so Mike wouldn't hear, "I'm too goddamn nervous to do it." I was nervous, too. I'd bulldozed her into this, after all. I had help from Mike, true, but I was the adult. If it went wrong, it would be on me. I wasn't much for prayer, but as I loaded Mike's crutches and wheelchair into the back of the van, I sent one up that nothing would go wrong. Then I backed out of the driveway, turned on the beach drive, and drove past the billboard reading, "Bring your kids to Joyland for the time of their lives." Annie was in the passenger seat, and I thought she had never looked more beautiful than she did that October morning, in her faded jeans and a light sweater, her hair tied back with a hank of blue yarn. "Thank you for this, Dev," she said. "I just hope we're doing the right thing." "We are," I said, trying to sound more confident than I felt, because now that it was a done deal, I had my doubts. The Joyland sign was lit up. That was the first thing I noticed. The second was that the summertime Get Happy music was playing through the loudspeakers, a sonic parade of late 60s and early 70s hits. I had intended to park in one of the Lot A handicap spaces. They were only 50 feet or so from the park entrance. But before I could do so, Fred Dean stepped through the open gate and beckoned us forward. Today he wasn't wearing just any suit, but the three-piece he saved for the occasional celebrity who raided a VIP tour. The suit I had seen, but never the black silk top hat, which looked like the kind you saw diplomats wearing in old newsreel footage.
"Is this usual?" Annie asked.
"Sure," I said, a trifle giddily. None of it was usual. I drove through the gate and onto Joyland Avenue, pulling up next to the park bench outside the Wiggle Waggle Village where I had once sat with Mr. Easterbrook after my first turn as Howie. Mike wanted to get out of the van the way he had gotten in, by himself. I stood by, ready to catch him if he lost his balance, while Annie hoisted the wheelchair out of the back. Milo sat at my feet, tail thumping, ears cocked, eyes bright. As Annie rolled the wheelchair up, Fred approached in a cloud of aftershave. He was resplendent. There's really no other word for it. He took off his hat, bowed to Annie, then held out a hand.
"You must be Mike's mother."
You have to remember the Ms. wasn't common usage back then, and nervous as I was, I took a moment to appreciate how deftly he had avoided the Miss-Mrs. dichotomy.
"I am," she said. I don't know if she was flustered by his courtliness or by the difference in the way they were dressed. She, amusement park casual, he, state visit formal. But flustered she was. She shook his hand, though. "And this young man,
is Michael.
He offered his hand to the wide-eyed boy standing there in his steel supports.
Thank you for coming today.
You're welcome. I mean, thank you. Thank you for having us. He shook Fred's hand.
This place is huge!
It wasn't, of course. Disney World is huge. But to a 10-year-old who had never been to an amusement park, it had to look that way. For a moment I could see it through his eyes, see it new, and my doubts about bringing him began to melt away. Fred bent down to examine the third member of the Ross family, hands on his knees.
And you're Milo.
Milo barked.
Yes, Fred said. And I'm equally pleased to meet you.
He held out his hand, waiting for Milo to raise his paw. When he did, Fred shook it.
How do you know our dog's name?
Annie asked. Did Dev tell you? He straightened, smiling.
He did not. I know because this is a magic place, my dear. For instance,
he showed her his empty hands and put them behind his back.
Which hand?
Left, Annie said, playing along. Fred brought out his left hand, empty. She rolled her eyes, smiling.
Okay, right.
This time, he brought out a dozen roses. Real ones. Annie and Mike gasped. Me too. All these years later, I have no idea how he did it.
Joyland is for children, my dear. And since today Mike is the only child here, this park belongs to him. These, however, are for you.
She took them like a woman in a dream, burying her face in the blooms, smelling their sweet red dust. I'll put them in the van for you, I said. She held them a moment longer, then passed them to me.
Mike, Fred said, do you know what we sell here?
He looked uncertain.
Rides? Rides and games?
We sell fun. So what do you say we have some?
I remember Mike's day at the park, Annie's day too, as if it happened last week. But it would take a correspondent much more talented than I am to tell you how it felt. Or to explain how it could have ended the last hold Wendy Keegan still held over my heart and my emotions. All I can say is what you already know. Some days are treasure. Not many. But I think in almost every life, there are a few. That was one of mine. And when I'm blue, when life comes down on me and everything looks tawdry and cheap the way Joyland Avenue did on a rainy day, I go back to it. If only to remind myself that life isn't always a butcher's game. Sometimes the prizes are real. Sometimes they're precious. Of course, not all the rides were running. That was okay because there were a lot of them Mike couldn't handle. But more than half of the park was operational that morning. The lights, the music, even some of the shies, where a half dozen gazoonies were on duty selling popcorn, fries, sodas, cotton candy, and pupilicious dogs. I have no idea how Fred and Lane pulled it off in a single afternoon, but they did. We started in the village, where Lane was waiting beside the engine of the Choo Choo Wiggle. He was wearing a Pillow Tick engineer's cap instead of his derby, but it was cocked at the same insouciant angle. Of course it was.
All aboard! This is a ride that makes kids happy, so get on board and make it snappy. Dogs ride free, moms ride free, kids ride up in the engine with me.
He pointed at Mike, then to the passenger seat in the engine. Mike got out of his chair, set his crutches, then tottered on them. Annie started for him.
No, Mom, I'm okay. I can do it.
He got his balance and clanked to where Lane was standing, a real boy with robot legs, and allowed Lane to boost him into the passenger seat.
Is that the cord that blows the whistle? Can I pull it?
That's what it's there for, Lane said. But watch out for pigs on the tracks. There's a wolf in the area, and they're scared to death of them.
Annie and I sat in one of the cars. Her eyes were bright. Roses all her own burned in her cheeks. Her lips, though tightly pressed together, were trembling.
You okay? I asked her.
Yes. She took my hand, laced her fingers through mine, and squeezed almost tight enough to hurt. Yes, yes, yes.
Controls green across the board, Lane cried. Check me on that, Michael.
Check.
Watch out for what on the tracks?
Pigs.
Kid, you got a style that makes me smile. Give that yell rope a yank and we're off.
Mike yanked the cord, the whistle howled, Milo barked. The air brakes chuffed and the train began to move. Choo-Choo Wiggle was strictly a Zamp ride, okay? All the rides in the village were Zamps, meant mostly for boys and girls between the ages of 3 and 7. But you have to remember how seldom Mike Ross had gotten out, especially since his pneumonia the year before and how many days he had sat with his mother at the end of that boardwalk, listening to the rumble of the rides and the happy screams coming from down the beach, knowing that stuff wasn't for him. What was for him was more gasping for air as his lungs failed, more coughing, a gradual inability to walk even with the aid of crutches and braces, and finally the bed where he would die, wearing diapers under his PJs and an oxygen mask over his face. Wiggle Waggle Village was sort of depopulated with no greenies to play the fairy tale parts, but Fred and Lane had reactivated all the mechanicals. The magic beanstalk that shot out of the ground in a burst of steam, the witch cackling in front of the candy house, the Mad Hatter's tea party, the nightcap-wearing wolf who lurked beneath one of the underpasses and sprang at the train as it passed. As we rounded the final turn, we passed 3 houses all kids know well. One of straw, one of sticks, and one of bricks. "Watch out for pigs!" Lane cried. And just then they came waddling onto the tracks, uttering amplified oinks. Mike shrieked with laughter and yanked the whistle. As always, the pigs escaped. Barely. When we pulled back into the station, Annie let go of my hand and hurried up to the engine. "Are you okay, hon? Want your inhaler?"
"No, I'm fine."
Mike turned to Lane.
"Thanks, Mr. Engineer."
"My pleasure, Mike."
He held out a hand, palm up.
"Slap me 5 if you're still alive."
Mike did, and with gusto. I doubt if he'd ever felt more alive.
"Now I've got to move on," Lane said. "Today I'm a man of many hats."
He dropped me a wink. Annie vetoed the Whirly Cups, but allowed Mike, not without apprehension, to ride the Cheroplanes. She gripped my arm even harder than she had my hand when the chair rose 30 feet above the ground and began to tilt, then loosened up again when she heard him laughing.
"God," she said. "Look at his hair, how it flies out behind him."
She was smiling. She was also crying, but didn't seem aware of it, nor of my arm, which had found its way around her waist. Fred was running the controls and knew enough to keep the ride at half speed, rather than bringing it all the way up to full, which would have had Mike parallel to the ground, held in only by centrifugal force. When he finally came back to Earth, the kid was too dizzy to walk. Annie and I each took an arm and guided him to the wheelchair. Fred toted Mike's crutches.
"Oh, man."
It seemed to be all he could say.
"Oh, man. Oh, man."
The Dizzy Speedboats, a land ride in spite of its name, was next. Mike rode over the painted water and one with Milo, both of them clearly loving it. Annie and I took another one. Although I had been working at Joyland for over 4 months by then, I had never been on this ride, and I yelled the first time I saw us rushing prow first at Mike and Milo's boat, only to sheer off at the last second. "Wimp," Annie shouted in my ear. When we got off, Mike was breathing hard but still not coughing. We rolled him up Hound Dog Way and grabbed sodas. The Gazoonie refused to take the 5 spot Annie held out.
"Everything's on the house today, ma'am."
"Can I have a pup, Mom, and some cotton candy?"
She frowned, then sighed and shrugged.
"Okay, just as long as you understand that stuff is still off limits, Buster. Today's an exception and no more fast rides."
He wheeled ahead to the Pupalicious Shy, his own pup trotting beside him. She turned to me. "It's not about nutrition, if that's what you're thinking. If he gets sick to his stomach, he might vomit, and vomiting is dangerous for kids in Mike's condition. They..." I kissed her. Just a gentle brush of my lips across hers. It was like swallowing a tiny drop of something incredibly sweet.
"Hush," I said. "Does he look sick?"
Her eyes got very large. For a moment, I felt positive that she was going to slap me and walk away. The day would be ruined, and it would be my own stupid goddamn fault. Then she smiled, looking at me in a speculative way, and then made my stomach feel light. "I bet you could do better than that if you had half a chance." Before I could think of a reply, she was hurrying after her son. It really would have made no difference if she had hung around, because I was totally flummoxed. Annie, Mike, and Milo crowded into one car of the gondola glide, which crossed above the whole park on a diagonal. Fred, Dean, and I rode beneath them in one of the electric carts, with Mike's wheelchair tucked in back.
"Seems like a terrific kid," Fred commented.
"He is, but I never expected you to go all out like this."
"That's for you as much as for him. You've done the park more good than you seem to know, Dev. When I told Mr. Easterbrook I wanted to go big, he gave me the green light."
"You called him?"
"I did indeed."
"That thing with the roses, how'd you pull it off?" Fred shot his cuffs and looked modest.
"A magician never tells his secrets. Don't you know that?"
"Did you have a card and bunny gig when you were with the Blitz Brothers?"
"No, sir, I did not. All I did with the Blitzies was ride jock and drag the midway. And although I did not have a valid driver's license, I also drove a truck on a few occasions when we had to DS from some rube ranch or another in the dead of night."
"So where did you learn the magic?"
Fred reached behind my ear, pulled out a silver dollar, dropped it into my lap. "Here and there, all around the square. Better goose it a little, Jonesy, they're getting ahead of us."
From Skytop Station, where the gondola ride ended, we went to the merry-go-round. Lane Hardy was waiting. He had lost the engineer's cap and was once more sporting his derby. The park's loudspeakers were still pumping out rock and roll, but under the wide, flaring canopy of what's known in the talk as the Spinning Jenny, the rock was drowned out by the calliope playing A Bicycle Built for Two. It was recorded, but still sweet and old-fashioned. Before Mike could mount the dish, Fred dropped to one knee and regarded him gravely.
"You can't ride the Jenny without a Joyland hat," he said. "We call them dog taps. You got one?"
"No," Mike said. He still wasn't coughing, but dark patches had begun to creep out beneath his eyes. Where his cheeks weren't flushed with excitement, he looked pale. "I didn't know I was supposed to..." Fred took off his own hat, peered inside, showed it to us. It was empty, as all magicians' top hats must be when they are displayed to the audience. He looked into it again and brightened.
"Ah."
He brought out a brand new Joyland dog top and put it on Mike's head.
"Perfect. Now which beast do you want to ride? A horse? The unicorn? Marva the mermaid? Leo the lion?"
"Yes, the lion, please," Mike cried. "Mom, you ride the tiger right next to me."
"You bet," she said. "I've always wanted to ride a tiger." "Hey, champ," Lane said. "Let me help you up the ramp."
While he did that, Annie lowered her voice and spoke to Fred. "Not a lot more, okay? It's all great, a day he'll never forget, but..."
"He's fading," Fred said. "I understand."
Annie mounted the snarling, green-eyed tiger next to Mike's lion. Milo sat between them, grinning a doggy grin. As the merry-go-round started to move, A Bicycle Built for Two gave way to 12th Street Rag. Fred put his hand on my shoulder.
"You'll want to meet us at the spin. We'll make that his last ride, but you need to visit the costume shop first, and put some hustle into it."
I started to ask why, then realized I didn't need to. I headed for the back lot, and yes, I put some hustle into it. That Tuesday morning, in October of 1973, was the last time I wore the fur. I put it on in the costume shop and used Joyland Under to get back to the middle of the park, pushing one of the electric carts as fast as it would go, my Howie head bouncing up and down on one shoulder. I surfaced behind Madame Fortuna's Shy just in time. Lane, Annie, and Mike were coming up the midway. Lane was pushing Mike's chair. None of them saw me peering around the corner of the Shy. They were looking at the Carolina Spin, their necks craned. Fred saw me, though. I raised a paw. He nodded, then turned and raised his own paw to whoever was currently watching from the little sound booth above customer services. Seconds later, Howie music rolled from all the speakers. First up was Elvis, singing Hound Dog. I leaped from cover, going into my Howie dance, which was kind of a fucked up soft shoe. Mike gaped. Annie clapped her hands to her temples as if she'd suddenly been afflicted with a monster headache, then started laughing. I believe what followed was one of my better performances. I hopped and skipped around Mike's chair, hardly aware that Milo was doing the same thing, only in the other direction. Hound Dog gave way to the Rolling Stones' version of Walking the Dog. That's a pretty short song, which was good. I hadn't realized how out of shape I was. I finished by throwing my arms wide and yelling, "Mike! Mike! Mike!" That was the only time Howie ever talked, and all I can say in my defense is that it really sounded more like a bark. Mike rose from his chair, opened his arms, and fell forward. He knew I'd catch him, and I did. Kids half his age had given me the Howie hug all summer long, but no hug had ever felt so good. I only wished I could turn him around and squeeze him the way I had Haley Stansfield, expelling what was wrong with him like an aspirated chunk of hot dog. Face buried in the fur, he said, "You make a really good Howie, Dev." I rubbed his head with one paw, knocking off his dog top. I couldn't reply as Howie. Barking his name was as close as I could come to that. But I was thinking, a good kid deserves a good dog. Just ask Milo. Mike looked up into Howie's blue mesh eyes. "Will you come on the hoister with us?" I gave him an exaggerated nod and patted his head again. Lane picked up Mike's new dog top and stuck it back on his head. Annie approached. Her hands were clasped demurely at her waist, but her eyes were full of merriment. "Can I unzip you, Mr. Howie?" I wouldn't have minded, but of course I couldn't let her. Every show has its rules, and one of Joyland's hard and fast was that Howie the Happy Hound was always Howie the Happy Hound. You never took off the fur where the conies could see. I ducked back into Joyland Under, left the fur in the cart, and rejoined Annie and Mike at the ramp leading up to the Carolina Spin. Annie looked up nervously and said, "Are you sure you want to do this, Mike?" "Yes, it's the one I want to do most." "All right, then, I guess." To me, she added, "I'm not terrified of heights, but they don't exactly thrill me." Lane was holding a car door open. "Climb aboard, folks. I'm going to send you up where the air is rare." He bent down and scruffed Milo's ears. "You're sitting this one out, fella." I sat on the inside nearest the wheel. Annie sat in the middle and Mike on the outside where the view was best. Lane dropped the safety bar, went back to the controls, and reset his derby on a fresh slant. "Amazement awaits," he called, and up we went, rising with the stately calm of a coronation procession. Slowly, the world opened itself beneath us, first the park, then the bright cobalt of the ocean on our right and all of the North Carolina lowlands on our left. When the spin reached the top of its great circle, Mike let go of the safety bar, raised his hands over his head, and shouted, "We're flying!" A hand on my leg, Annie's. I looked at her and she mouthed two words, "Thank you." I don't know how many times Lane sent us around, more spins than the usual ride, I think, but I'm not sure. What I remember best was Mike's face, pale and full of wonder, and Annie's hand on my thigh where it seemed to burn. She didn't take it away until we slowed to a stop. Mike turned to me. "Now I know what my kite feels like," he said. So did I. When Annie told Mike he had had enough, the kid didn't object. He was exhausted. As Lane helped him into his wheelchair, Mike held out a hand, palm up. "Slap me five if you're still alive." Grinning, Lane slapped him five. "Come back any time, Mike." "Thanks. It was so great." Lane and I pushed him up the midway. The booths on both sides were shut up again, but one of the shies was open. Annie Oakley's shooting gallery. Standing at the chump board where Pop Allen had stood all summer long was Fred Dean in his three-piece suit. Behind him, chain-driven rabbits and ducks traveled in opposite directions. Above them were bright yellow ceramic chicks. These were stationary, but very small.
"Like to try your shooting skill before you exit the park?" Fred asked. "There are no losers today. Today, everybody wins a prize."
Mike looked around at Annie.
"Can I, Mom?"
"Sure, honey. But not long, okay?" He tried to get out of the chair, but couldn't. He was too tired. Lane and I propped him up, one on each side. Mike picked up a rifle and took a couple of shots, but he could no longer steady his arms, even though the gun was light. The BBs struck the canvas backdrop and clicked into the gutter at the bottom. "Guess I suck," he said, putting the rifle down.
"Well, you didn't exactly burn it up,"
Fred allowed. But as I said, today everyone wins a prize. With that.